In the Chicago area, there's a private museum and gardens place called Cantini, spelled Cantigny, if you were going to look it up on the internet. And it's a wonderful place where there's a great museum, as well as many tanks, World War II tanks and even earlier stuff. And even they've even added their Desert Storm tank, and for boys and both young and old, climbing around on those tanks is great fun. And I would highly recommend it to go and look it out if you've never been there before. But you see the size of those tanks, and I'm always struck. I was familiar with the Soviet T-55 tank, which was very slight in its profile, very low and deceivingly low in its profile, in the sense of it could hide in a shallow dip or not very long grass, and kind of deceptively so, in the sense that you would not expect to be able to hide a tank in such a situation. The T-55 is a difficult target to neutralize because of its low profile and its good armor and stuff. But it does have a weak spot. Underneath the turret and the main body, you've got the wheels where the track goes on. And the wheels kind of protect that soft shell underneath. But there's a space between the first and the second wheel where there's no protection at all. And the armor is slightly thinner there as opposed to the turret area. And another thing what they have right in that spot is that's where the ammunition and the fuel are all stored. Now I can understand putting the fuel and ammunition together in the same spot. That just gives you one weak spot. You know, you hit the ammunition or you hit the fuel, you take us. But that's the sweet spot. That's the soft spot of the T-55. And if you put a good armor-piercing round into that spot, you're going to see a fantastic explosion. Well, those in the tank might not think it's so fantastic. But if you're serious about neutralizing a T-55 or any tank for that matter, you've got to hit it in a strategic place. Likewise, when the devil seeks to neutralize the effectiveness of God's kingdom, his strategic aim is upon the leadership in the home. If he can deny, derail, distort, somehow pollute that aspect of this important kingdom work, then the whole thrust of God's kingdom work is greatly hindered. Godly leadership in the home is not a side issue to the kingdom. It is central. It is absolutely critical. It's this very core we see of the kingdom. Therefore, we see this continuous assault against the leadership in the home, against these ideas. We see assault upon ourselves as leaders in the homes. It is vital that we not only preserve this aspect, and that we not only persevere in this important area, but that we constantly improve and advance in our leadership skills. Both young and old alike need to appreciate how critically important godly leadership in the home is. And godly leadership is nothing other than loving servant leadership. Those are synonymous terms in my mind. Godliness in leadership and loving servant leadership. Because that's what godly leadership looks like. It's unpacking for us. Loving servant leadership unpacks for us what godliness looks like. If you think about these three terms, loving servant leadership, you'll see that they imply each other and require each other, so that you kind of have to explain them all at the same time in order to understand one aspect of them. They hang together, they support each other, they imply one another, they demand one another. And each of these things needs to be emphasized in every act by the head of the family, loving servant leadership. There's no other way to lead in the home. And thus we need to keep these things before our eyes all the time. We are to be leaders who are strong. We are to be bold. We are to be unapologetic for our calling and our responsibility as leaders. However, this leadership must always be characterized by love and servanthood. And this comes out clearly in Christ's example of washing his disciples' feet. We read in John 13, verses 1 through 5. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. And after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel which he had was girded. And if you drop down to verse 12 through verse 17, it continues. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments and sat down again, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, having washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." The New King James Version at John 13:2 says, "And supper being ended." The English Standard Version and others have "during supper." These are poor translations. Young's literal translation says, "And supper being come." This, although somewhat awkward, is communicating what the Greek is saying. I translate it as, "and supper being ready." This is an important point in the whole story that is before us here. The whole concept and understanding of leadership and servant leadership. And the fact that so many translations miss it underlies the tendency towards ritualism rather than relevance. We have a great tendency towards ritualism, I assure you. I will explain what I mean by this a little later, but for now you need to know that the supper had been prepared and was about to be served. It was ready now for them to eat. They had gathered. Jesus doesn't at this time engage in a ritual act with the hope of communicating some subtle teaching point. No, the Last Supper was floundering. This important meal had been skewered on a crisis of no small significance. And Jesus' leadership qualities kicked into play. Leaders must take charge. They must lead in all areas and at all times. What was the crisis? Well, if you look at Leonardo da Vinci's picture of the Lord's Supper, it's not going to help you. His painting of the supper might be an amazing piece of art, but it is woeful history. He put Jesus and his disciples sitting around a modern dinner table. It could have been in Arlington Heights or in Elk Grove Village, sitting around having a meal at somebody's house. There was no table in the upper room. There were no chairs. Everything was going to take place on the floor. The food would be laid out on mats, and everyone would lie on a cushion and lie around this table, and they would be lying very close, very intimately with one another. Thus, John could lay his head on Jesus' breast. However, this intimate reclining setup meant that your feet were at face height, very close to one another. I hope you're not squeamish. If you are, it might be a good time to take a bathroom break. When people have been walking great distances with open sandals on dusty roads in hot climates and they arrive at the dinner date, I assure you their feet are not a pretty sight. Gooey, smelly feet. How do you enjoy a meal when someone's feet in this condition are not very far from your face? This is the situation. But this is not the crisis. What's the crisis? The crisis is the cultural understanding of what takes place in this situation. That's the crisis. How is this normally dealt with? The actual situation, or the actual solution, was very simple. Get someone to wash the feet. That's over. It's done. Problem solved. The crisis, however, was over who would wash the guest's feet. You see, the custom of the day was that the lowest servant or the lowest slave would be the one assigned this task of washing the guest's feet in a situation like this. Not just a slave, or not just a servant, but the lowest ranked servant and slave would be assigned this job, which kind of explains the horror of this job. Not the most pleasant thing to do. Well, here you have dinner that is ready. And the only people in the room are Jesus and his disciples. No servants, no slaves. This is a disaster. The disciples were paralyzed by this dilemma and had absolutely no idea how to proceed, because the furthest thing from their minds was that one of them should carry out this task. No ways am I doing that. No ways can I bow myself to succumb to such a thing, to such an action. Jesus, however, manifests true leadership, true servanthood. A leader takes charge in such situations and shows the way through instruction and example. This is how a leader lives. This is how we are to live. And he leads by example in all circumstances, manifesting servanthood at all times. The significant kingdom supper had stalled because every one of the disciples failed to grasp the true meaning of loving servant leadership. They all wanted to be leaders in the kingdom and had disputed amongst themselves and argued who was the greatest in Mark chapter 9. They wanted position without understanding what is key in God's mind to having position. This is what position is about. This is what leadership is about. Jesus exampled leadership, which entails taking the lead. It entails regarding others as better than oneself, which is true humility. And it entails sacrificing self for the benefit of others. Godly leadership is not about barking commands, but about serving the real needs of others. One of which of them is their need to see true servanthood in practice. People have a need to see that. And leaders need to demonstrate that. They need to show this is what leadership looks like. This is what servanthood looks like. And so they lead in that way and show what it looks like. Jesus could have said, you people should be washing each other's feet. What's the matter with you? How can you not get it into your thick heads? He doesn't do that. He examples it. He does leadership. Practical, selfless, humble service of doing what on the practical side needed to be done, but always by showing what true leadership entails. You see, a true leader leads by words and actions. In our society, we tend to think about a position of leadership and see it as the goal. That's what I'm going to attain. You know, once I've gone through this dog work and this kind of hard stuff and servant stuff, once I get past that, then I'm going to attain the position. I'm going to sit on the top of that position and then I'm going to lead. Once we've done these servant-like tasks, eventually we'll no longer have to do these menial things. Much like climbing a ladder, and you have to do the servant things to reach the top. But Jesus blows that idea away. And he shows that leadership is constant, humble, loving servanthood. That's what leadership is. Stop one of those things, remove one of those things, and you no longer have biblical leadership. Any concept of leadership that doesn't have these loving servant qualities is a distortion of leadership. The moment a leader drops the loving servant qualities, he is no longer exercising godly leadership. Jesus set the standard for leadership. It's his example that we are to follow. And he is the most highly ranked person in the kingdom. He is the Lord that sits in the heavens and yet served the real needs of these undeserving disciples. There is an important point about serving others that must not be missed in this example. I touched on it briefly when I had mentioned earlier about the ritual aspect that we are so prone to move towards. And often what Jesus did in John 13 is misunderstood. It's misapplied. And as I said, Da Vinci's famous painting of the Lord's Supper is misleading because it renders us incapable of understanding the issue. The image it presents turns what Jesus did into a ritualistic symbolic activity. Sitting at a Western side style table defies the need for foot washing. Defies the need. There's no need for this. As do the translations that say the supper being ended. It was not ended, it was about to begin. With everyone lying down on the ground, we know the scenario. This does not set a context for a great appetizing meal with somebody's feet like that in your face. I remember when I'd completed, in the military, I'd completed a survival aspect, a survival course aspect of my training. And we'd been out for many, many days in a very hot climate at the day and very cold at night, just wearing a pair of shorts and a shirt and boots, nothing else, and you're sleeping in the dust, and you've got fires at night to try and keep you warm, but you can't get warm, and you're just thick with grime and sweat and dirt and gunge. And I remember a plane came in to fetch us at the end of this, and landed and picked us up, and we got onto this plane and took off, and we're going back. And the pilot very graciously came through, the co-pilot came through to greet us. And I remember vividly seeing him gag as he walked, opened this door and he walked into our, where these filthy men were housed. And he literally gagged, the smell and the stench. That's not appetizing at all. And that's the context we have at the Lord's Supper. That's the practical reality that they were faced with. You know, the Pope, in the tradition of Rome, loves ritual, and therefore he washes some cardinal's feet at Easter time on a stage for the world to see. I think he does it at that stage, I'm not sure. But this is this ritual that he goes through, and he washes this man's feet. I'm a servant of Christ. Brethren, that is utterly irrelevant. It is an absolute distortion of what Christ did. It is misleading. It is deceiving. If your church does foot washing, please cease and desist. It's irrelevant. You are teaching the wrong message. You are sending a message about what Christ has done here that is completely distorting what he truly did. I realize I'm probably stepping on toes here, but just realize how significant this is to get a true understanding of what Jesus did. Let's not turn it into a ritual. The sinful nature of man tends to swing towards ritualism and away from relevance. The furthest thing from true Christianity is ritualism. We're going to do this ritual because it signifies this, and it signifies this, and we want to signify. We don't want to signify anything. We want to do. We want to be. We want to manifest what Christ has called us to manifest. And what he manifests here is what we want to do. Do this, he says, if I've done it. Imitate me in doing this. As irrelevant as washing each other's feet in our context, in our culture, would be if somebody was sick at home, and I went into their house, and I pulled out all their cutlery from their cupboards and their crockery, and I washed it for them, and then put it back and said, hey, I've come to be a servant. Utterly irrelevant, as well as probably insulting. Service of Christ is relevant, practical. The sick person maybe needs a meal to be cooked, needs their dirty laundry to be washed. But that's what servanthood is practically dealing with the needs that people need. The help that they need. Do not reduce Christ's example in John 13 to a symbolic act, to a ritual, and then turn your imitation of Christ into symbolic ritual. It's very practical, very down to earth. True biblical servanthood is doing things that are dusty and relevant and that truly benefit others. And as husbands in our homes, that's how we need to think about servanthood. That's how we need to think about our leadership. We've got to serve in very practical, meaningful ways where we meet the real needs of each person in our family as we meet the real needs of our wives. What does she need? Do you know that one of the most basic and dusty ways you can love and serve your wife and your family as a leader is making sure that you place yourself under godly elders? This is practical stuff. How can I truly lead my wife? I'm going to submit myself to godly leadership. You see, because one of the key ways that you love and serve your wife is by protecting her. And critical to her protection and protection to your whole family is you making yourself accountable to godly oversight. Not being a law unto yourself. Not being unaccountable. You see, this is dusty love. This is dusty servanthood. How come, you ask? Well, firstly, fundamental to your family's security is their submission to God, to His ordained authority structures. Fundamental to your family, to their protection, that they submit to God's ordained structures. And thus your own humble submission to God and His ordained structures provides them vital protection that they need. As I submit myself, I am providing protection for them. So that I'm not a loose cannon rolling around the place and firing in every direction. Secondly, your example of bowing to those in authority over you shows those under your authority how they are expected to bow to authority. You manifested, you demonstrated to them. You show them this is what submission looks like. This is what bowing your will to somebody else's will looks like. You're also saying to your family that to the degree that you bow yourself to authority, that's the style, that's the level that you want them to bow to your authority. It's a challenge. You see, a tyrant expects obedience and submission from others that he himself is not willing to give. Ephesians 5 tells husbands that their leadership in the home is to be a reflection of Christ's ultimate self-sacrifice in the work of redemption. Verse 25 of Ephesians 5 says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her." And then verses 28 through 33 exhort, "So husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh and of his bones. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." So here we're told by Paul that to love your wife is to love yourself. Now this is not emotional stuff we're talking about. Oh, I have these feelings of emotion. No, this is practical service. This is practical service in advancing the kingdom. This cause. When a husband loves his wife, that is, when he relates to her according to God's revealed will, he is advancing himself. He is advancing his call and his responsibility, which is all to focus upon Christ and Christ's kingdom and accomplish what Christ has called him to do. And when he does that, he's focusing upon the very fundamental thing that he needs to accomplish. You cannot have the striving and separation and not realize that how can I be treating my wife in a certain way or not loving her as I should and think that I'm fulfilling God's purpose and kingdom. It's tied together, it's united, it's one thing. And when I have this responsibility on me from God, when I'm doing and loving my wife in the way I should, I am fulfilling that calling and that responsibility. Therefore, I am loving myself, I'm serving myself, I'm building up this foundation that I need to be building. Jesus sacrifices himself for us, but in doing so, he advances his own cause. And our cause is Christ and Christ's kingdom. And the way we advance that is to truly sacrifice ourselves. the servant aspect or mindset comes out in John 13. The loving aspect, we're going to define love as to what that looks like, would come out in 1 Corinthians 13. Which we don't have time to deal with all of that. But love, according to Paul in 1 Corinthians 13, is long-suffering. It's being patient in all our relating. It means passionately pursuing patience so that we might hold back wrath in all our dealings. To do this is mighty kingdom work. To hold back, to be long-suffering is mighty kingdom work. People talk about being effective for God's kingdom and desiring to tear down the walls of Satan's kingdom. We want to do that. We want to gain the victory over the kingdom of darkness. Well, Proverbs tells us in Proverbs 16, verse 13, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city." Control yourself, and you're more mighty than a soldier who conquers a city. If you've ever read the story of Braveheart and the cities he conquered, the castles, it's a credible story, and I suggest you read it if you haven't. William Wallace, great man of courage. But when we rule our spirits in our homes, when we control our anger and control ourselves in our homes, we are more powerful and we are more devastating to the kingdom of darkness than he who conquers a city. These are important understandings to have in our mind in order to help us bring ourselves into subjection and submit ourselves to God's truth. He who rules his spirit is greater in the working of the kingdom than the one who takes a city. Ecclesiastes 7 verses 8 and 9 tells us that the angry person is a proud fool. It says, "The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools." And that's a characteristic we need to imbibe and let flow throughout our family and particularly in our dealings with our wives. The person who is long-suffering sees the kingdom and knows that his patience is building the kingdom. When we suffer long, we are making real advances in our own sanctification as well as helping those around us to mature in their conformity to the image of Christ. This is incredibly powerful kingdom work and something that leaders must pursue, something that they ought to manifest in all their relationships, but especially in the relationships in their homes. Paul told the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14, he said, "Warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all." Being patient with all is powerful, more powerful than tearing down the walls of an enemy city. Love is kind. Kindness has to do with uprightness, acting in an excellent way towards someone, which means acting in accordance with God's truth. To be kind to someone is to do what is excellent and most needful in that situation. It means relating to them in a way that will be most useful for advancing them in the kingdom. I'd very much like to go through the whole of Paul's teaching on 1 Corinthians 13 about what love looks like, but there isn't time for that. However, in touching upon the long-suffering and kindness, it shows how we ought to understand love and how the loving leadership ought to manifest in all these other areas. All those things that Paul exalts in 1 Corinthians 13, those are the things we need to imitate. We should manifest them. And we shouldn't have any of the negative things in our lives as well. That's what loving leadership looks like. This is what it looks like to lead in my home, to lovingly and servant with a servant's heart lead. Leadership that doesn't reflect Paul's definition of love will be oppressive. It will not be advancing the kingdom. Rather than building the family, it will be tearing it down. If family leaders are not persevering in loving those whom they are leading, then the most fundamental unit in the kingdom, which is the family unit, will be incapable of playing its part in the unfolding of God's plan. Absolutely central to the family's effectiveness is the husband's style of leadership, his principles of leadership, how he manifests it, and how he shows forth this. One of the hardest callings in life is to be a leader of the family. And it's also one of the most critically important. The pressure and the responsibility that rests upon the leader's shoulders is massive, and it's vital that we understand the seriousness of this calling and how to effectively carry it out. To succeed in this calling, we need constant grace from God to be vigilant and strong, to be effective, as well as grace to continue manifesting and perfecting loving servant leadership. You see, in the light of Paul likening the marriage relationship to Christ and His church, how significant a role does self-sacrifice play in the bringing of the bride to perfection? That's what Ephesians is all about. Christ's sacrifice in order to bring His bride to perfection. There's the key. There's an incredible aspect of our leadership as we sacrifice self in order to bring our brides to perfection by the grace and the working of God. It's a responsibility. Now, it's not our work. It's Christ's work. And He is working in our wives independently of us as well in that sense. But He is working through us. And we are a channel and a means in order to accomplish that. By sacrificing Himself, Christ perfects His bride by dying for her and then leading her to maturity through His love and service. Self-sacrifice, what does it look like? We could look at many things and we don't have time to touch upon them all, but self-sacrifice, sacrificing myself for my bride as Christ sacrificed Himself for His bride, how does that look? One aspect of self-sacrifice has to do with not fearing your wife's displeasure when you exercise loving servant leadership. That's one aspect. A leader must lead. And an important responsibility of leadership is protecting your wife from her own emotional swells. Ladies are much more emotional than men, if you have not noticed. And she needs to be guided and protected in this thing. But a loving, guiding and protecting and nurturing her in this situation where she is, just as Christ does that with us. An important aspect of helping your wife come to maturity is helping her gain victory over her fears and her emotions. She needs to know that you will not cave in to these emotions, to her emotions where there's fears, and sometimes what comes into that with the emotions is a manipulation in order to work the situation out. When she knows she cannot manipulate you according to her emotions, this will give her great security. And it will also protect your children from being subjected to roller coaster rides of emotions in the family. Emotions have a place in the family, but they are never meant to be in charge. And if we refuse as men in this area to lead, the family's instability will be perpetuated. The system and this basis of emotionally being led will be passed on to the next generation. Our daughters will do the same, and our sons will be weak and effeminate because there's been this emotional roller coaster where it's emotions to get you to comply as opposed to principle and truth and according to God's word. And this is not going to be negative to our wives in any sense. This is a reality, and this is what servant leadership does. This is how Christ ministers to us. Comes into our weaknesses and He ministers to us and strengthens us so that we can mature and know how to deal through them and weather the storm. Men must be men and lead and not fear. For we know how we've often reacted to the Lord when He's held the line with us and said, hey, this is what it is. And yet later as we've looked back and we've said, I'm so grateful that He did not waver. That He held that line. We provide a great service to our wives when we help them in their sanctification through strong, loving leadership. The leading aspect is vital in this combination of loving servant leadership. So men must be strong leaders. However, in our day, this is as far as many people take it. Strong leaders. Which is in reality not biblical leadership at all. As I've already said, when leadership is not tied to love and servanthood, it is oppressive. And Jesus said in Matthew 20, verses 25 through 28, he called to His disciples, and He said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. You see, loving servant leadership is not mystical. It really is dusty, and I hope you get used to that term because I'm going to be using it the whole weekend. It's very dusty, it's very relevant, it's down to earth in this realm where we live. The old pictures that they used to do, the spiritualistic pictures as you call them, was they painted people, the saints and particularly Jesus and the apostles, if you see any ancient artwork, they painted them floating above the ground. They were kind of removed from the real tangible dusty aspects of life, because that's how we pictured holiness, was kind of disengaged from the earth, not walking with their feet in the dust, not getting sweaty and smelly. But true Christianity is very dusty. It's getting down there and wrestling in the dust, and it's knowing the dustiness of life. And loving servanthood is not mystical, but dusty. And Jesus says, you are not to lord it over people. On another occasion, when Jesus was talking about those who sin against you, but when they repent, you must forgive them, even if it's up to seven times a day, in Luke 17. He's talking about being gracious and generous in dealing with those, with others, saying that if someone actually sins seven times, you must forgive them. And the disciples said, this is madness. He says, if you expect us to live like that, you better give us more faith. And Jesus said that it wasn't an increase of faith that they needed, but a correct understanding about true servanthood. And Jesus explained in Luke 17, verses 7 through 10. Which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he comes in from the field, come at once and sit down to eat? But will he not rather say to him, prepare something for my supper, and gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drunk, and afterward you will eat and drink? Does he thank the servant because he did these things that he commanded him? I think not. So likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do. You see, it wasn't greater faith the disciples needed. To be servant leaders, it's not faith we need, but a better understanding about the dusty nature of self-sacrifice. The servant has been plowing in the field the whole day. That's hard work. He's tired. He's exhausted. He comes in and the master says, hey, first things first, my food. I need it now. The servant says, fine, gird myself, clean up, wash up, prepare the food for the master and bring it to him. And then afterwards, you can go and serve yourself. And you're only doing what is expected of you. Basically, he's saying to him, suck it up. You've got responsibilities to fulfill. Let's get them done. Dusty perseverance. Not lording it over your family, but self-sacrificial service of their real needs. Sacrificial to the degree where we're talking about where this servant comes in from the field and those emotions and feelings that he has, the tiredness. You see, leaders have to be particularly disciplined because they are able to rule in their own favor. We can stack the deck if we want, so it always works out in our favor. Because we're making the call. We have the authority to make the decisions, but that's not what we're supposed to do. That's what the Gentiles do. Jesus is saying, no, this is not what you're going to do. And if you want to know what servanthood is, look at the servant who served his master first before him. Servant leadership is self-sacrificial, and self-sacrifice is painful. Thus the leader needs to learn how to endure pain and self-consciously persevere in living in this way. Husbands and fathers, we need to graduate from this self-serving aspect to need to sacrifice and serve ourselves in the sense of sacrificing and serving for our families in dusty and practical ways. We must stay vigilant in seeking opportunities to sacrifice. Young men, it is vital that you too realize the importance of establishing self-sacrifice in your own lives. If you see how central this is to the kingdom and to leadership, you should be anxious not to miss any opportunity to sacrifice yourself, to endure hardness, to know what it means to deny selves in order to serve somebody else. I heard of a story once of these boys playing airsoft, if you know what that is, shooting those little plastic BBs at each other in a war context. And there was one boy who was made a leader. And so he got the rest members of his team in this difficult situation, and he put them in front of himself, and he was behind them, using them as a shield and moving forward against the enemy. Brethren, he failed in an opportunity to understand what leadership is. He failed to exercise and practice at that point what servant leadership looks like. You know exactly where he should have been. In the front, taking the shots for his people that he was leading and that were supposed to be his guys. But he obviously thought in his mind, I'm a better, more significant, important person, and therefore they should die for me. Leaders need to be tough. They need to learn how to endure strain and pain without complaining. We need to banish from our minds forever the picture of chubby little cherubs sitting on clouds somewhere playing harps. Brethren, that's not Christianity. That's not what we're hoping to achieve. That's not what we're aiming to arrive at. We want to be men. We want to be strong. We want to endure and suffer hardness for the sake, in the name of sacrificing self for the kingdom. Men in this world to benefit others. Being prepared to die. And we are to practice dying to, by manifesting dying to self daily. In every opportunity that comes our way, we practice dying to self. Practical self-sacrifice and perseverance when you are hungry. When you're hungry. Paul talked about people in Philippians 3 and verse 19. He said, their God is their belly. You can unpack lots from that. But this is dusty stuff. If your God is your belly, then you will not learn how to deny self. For example, when you are hungry, you will deny God's truth when your hunger overrides God's call to place yourself second. Place yourself last. And my hunger takes over. That now becomes the thing that guides me, that governs me, that directs me. If you do not master these things, then the flesh will rule and you will not mature past those chubby little cherubs on the clouds. Or the chubby little baby that the first hunger pang that hits it, it lets the world know, I'm in need of food now and it better be served quickly. And we're tired. What do? When we're tired? We have to manifest godly leadership. We have to manifest what it means to be a man, to be a leader in this context. That's what we do. When we're thirsty, when we're cold. When we're cold, we prepare to give our jacket to somebody else who is cold. Finding opportunities. Denying self, sacrificing self. Christ's exhortation about going the extra mile is very relevant to sacrificing self. It becomes a cliche in our day, go the extra mile. But that was in a very down-to-earth practical situation that this counsel was given. In Matthew 5 and verse 41, you had Rome who was leading and oppressing the nation of Israel. And they made a law because they've got their soldiers and everybody's got their equipment to carry around. And so you had a Roman soldier who would be carrying this massive pack going from A to B. And so Rome passed a law and said, you can compel a Jew to carry your pack 1 mile and help you and assist you in this journey. That was it. You couldn't argue, debate. That was the law. And so the Roman would find a Jew, he'd be looking around, there he saw his Jew, hey, come and carry my pack. Big, heavy pack, hot, dusty days, and the guy's got to carry this pack. Now you can know what's going on inside. You know, I was on my way to do an important task. I've suddenly been called on, and I've got to walk a mile in this direction, completely in the opposite way. The pressures of life, the turmoil, the resentment, the hatred, you can imagine what's going on inside this man. Jesus says, hey, compels you to go a mile? You go two. Deny self. Deny self and manifest this complete self-denial and sacrifice. And the Roman soldier is walking with this Jew, and as he's approaching the end of a mile, when you walk a lot, you know how far a mile is. So you're coming to the end of the mile, and you're starting to look around for somebody else. Who can I find the next guy to carry my pack? And he looks at this guy and who's carrying his pack, and he just keeps going. Oh well, if he's a fool, I'll let him see how far he's going to go. Can you see what leadership is? What sacrifice is when it's hard and it's tough? And you bring your flesh under and you say, I'm doing this in the name of Christ for His kingdom and for His glory? But that's what's got to exemplify our lives. That mindset, that understanding, and that practicing of sacrifice. This is a very sobering verse in Peter's epistle. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. Husbands, likewise dwell with them, with your wives, with understanding, giving honor to the wife as the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. If that doesn't send chills down your back, then no verse will. God is saying, beware how you live with your wife so that God doesn't hinder your prayers. He doesn't make the heavens brass to your praying. Hey, tough man, you got it all together. Well, you're on your own now. That's what God is saying. You're on your own. You don't need my help. You face the world without me. When we haven't got access and communication with God, that's what we've got. The wife is a weaker vessel. She is weaker physically. She's weaker emotionally. And she's weaker positionally. And yet she's a joint heir. Of all the glories and riches of heaven. Of all the standing before God. Her standing and her value in the kingdom is equal with that of her husband. And he is accountable to use his position and his authority, his superior strength, to benefit her and bring her to maturity. To protect her. To build her up. Without demeaning her in any way. Or being condescending. He's to sacrifice himself for her benefit. As Jesus gave himself to bring us to maturity. I just want to focus briefly as we come to an end upon the positional weakness aspect, which many times men don't quite appreciate. It's hard for a husband to appreciate just how vulnerable a wife is. And we should never presume upon what a wife does when she says at the altar, I do. I do. Will you honor and respect and obey? I do. I will. Realize what's going on there. We're not in that kind of a position. I don't think we ever will be. Where what she's saying is, your word in any situation in my life, obviously within the parameters of godliness, but there's so many dynamics within that. Your word is my final word now. Totally, totally at your beck and call, to use a very weak phrase. Totally vulnerable. Completely given to what you decide. That's where I am. And I'm trusting you in this. That's what a wife is agreeing to. She's saying the details with all my life, all those things can be determined by you, and I'm trusting you. Potentially, it's a very scary position to willingly hand yourself over to. And it's vital that husbands appreciate how incredibly vulnerable a wife's position is. And thus one can appreciate why God says, if you do not dwell with your wife according to understanding, I will shut the heavens to you. I will not hear your prayers. And that should keep us very conscious and aware of our responsibility in dwelling with our wives according to understanding. Part of a husband's leadership involves leading his wife to the position of complete trust and submission to his leadership. A vital aspect of bringing her to maturity, where she truly does bow herself and humble herself and follow. However, what we need to realize, that vital to helping her do this, we must demonstrate character that is dependable and self-sacrificial and loving. A husband having these qualities is not the basis of a wife's submission, by the way. A wife is told to honor and submit to her husband. That's God's command to her. And if we had wives in our audience today, I would be saying that to them. That's your responsibility. Wives are to honor their husbands even when they are not exemplifying Christ-likeness. For Scripture tells them that they can win their husband through a quiet and gentle spirit, as we read in 1 Peter 3 verses 3. Through 6, just before verse 7 that we're looking at. But since I'm speaking to men and boys who are to be servant leaders, I'm focusing upon responsibilities which are we have to help our wife and your future wives in their sanctification. Do you help them to perfect Christ in their lives as Christ goes about perfecting His body? You see, you make your wife's growth in sanctification so much easier when you manifest Christ-likeness. Understand her fears and her weaknesses and her emotional swells, and dwell with her according to understanding. Strengthen her, build her up, and encourage her in this calling and this task. Help her to fully trust your leadership. It's extremely hard to wholeheartedly entrust yourself to a selfish person, or to a bully, or to somebody who's indifferent to your needs. How do you entrust yourself wholeheartedly to that? Doesn't this deny the very thing that Christ is teaching us about why we should bow to Him, why we should trust Him and follow Him? We've got to keep those parallels running all the time in our thinking. Demonstrating self-sacrifice. You see, Jesus calls on us to submit to Him and obey Him in the context of exampling servanthood, self-sacrifice, immovable, unshakable love for us. I love you. Look what I've done for you. Look what I'm doing for you. That's the context, He says, for you to obey Me, to submit yourself to My will, to follow Me wholeheartedly. That's the context. And that must be the same context that we present for our wives in order to help them. I want you to follow Me, honey. I want you to obey. I want you to honor. I want you to lead this way. And I'm showing you that I am worthy of being followed. Because doing that, you're helping her in her sanctification, helping her in bowing herself to you. Demonstrating self-sacrifice not only examples this way of life to those whom you are leading and training, but it makes your followers confident in your leadership. Do you know the impact that a relatively small unit like a family can make when they believe in their leader? When they do not doubt that he is truly seeking their benefit before his own. No, truly, I know, out of a shadow of a doubt, that he is seeking my benefit above his own. I see it all day long. I see this manifested. And that gives me great courage and strength to sacrifice myself and follow this path. The way they come to believe this about our leadership is by seeing us place ourselves time and time again last, sacrificing self for their benefit. Young men, learn this principle now before you are a husband. Practice it every day. Serve your siblings. Serve your parents. Serve anybody who needs service. Look around for it. Practice it. Manifest it. Deny self. Practice enduring hardness where you're denying self for the benefit of others. And fathers, example this to your children and serve your wife as Christ ministers to His church. Do you know that within your hands, as a husband and a father, resides incredible potential for the kingdom? If we can just believe the centrality and the power of being loving servant leaders. The gates of hell will not be able to stand against the thrust and the power of families that are governed and led by this kind of thing. They will not stand. The gates of hell will crumble time and time again. Because this is the power of the kingdom of God. It's a manifestation of Christ. We saw in John 13 what servanthood looks like. And in some other passages. We saw in 1 Corinthians 13 what love is supposed to be characterized as. We need to meditate upon these qualities. And the goal that we have and the goal that I leave with us is that our wives might be sanctified, which is Christ's goal for us. And how we go about doing that, I believe we have seen in great detail this morning with the many different scriptures. Much more could be said and should be said on this important and vital subject. But I pray that enough has been given for you to meditate upon and to dwell upon. And I pray that the Lord would indeed make us mighty warriors as we apply these truths to our own families. God bless you.